Hi everyone, welcome to The Intense Mind, a podcast for intense people. My name is Emmy and I'm here with you to learn and grow from gifted and intense minds around the world. Hi, in today's episode we have a special guest, Eric Weinhorst, a registered psychotherapist, educator, mentor and writer. Eric's journey began with a personal crisis in his mid-20s, leading him on a transformative path. Today, Eric openly shares his journey of self-discovery. We delve into many topics from quantum physics to ego consciousness to the intersections of masculinity, giftedness, sensitivity, and relationships. Eric shares his insights on the profound loneliness experienced by a highly gifted, sensitive person, especially as a man, and how hard it is to find authentic connection. So let's dive deep into this enriching dialogue with Eric Weinhorst.
Hi, Eric. Nice to meet you.
Hi, Amy. Nice to meet you as well.
Yeah. It's so good to have you here. Well, we've been Facebook friends for a long time, for a while.
Yep.
I'm glad
I've been reading your books for a while as well.
Oh, have you?
Yeah.
Actually, I didn't know that.
Yeah. The emotional intensity and sensitivity. I work with a lot of clients whose profiles really match up with the way you describe, including you have a strong focus on kind of like childhood trauma as well and recognizing kind of the intersections of these things. So I appreciate your work. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for telling me that. So since you're here, can you tell us about yourself and where you've come from, a bit about your background and journey?
Yeah, of course. So I'm Eric Weinhorst. I am, well, a human being and several other things, potentially, let's just say. So I'm a counselor, registered psychotherapist, mentor, coach. I come alongside people at kind of various stages of their own kind of journeys towards, becoming who they kind of authentically are. So I tend to work with people who are a bit outside of the box. So neurodivergence, giftedness, creativity, emotional intensity and sensitivity, creative people who just don't seem to fit into neatly into any boxes that most societies, or at least Westernized societies, tend to kind of espouse. And why do I work with people like that? Well, I am a person like that. And so there's kind of a felt sense of resonance and a felt sense of understanding often. And I'm particularly interested, at this kind of point in my evolution as a person, in working with people who are going through major kind of personal transformations. So I often work, or at least I kind of reference Kazimierz Dabrowski's work.
Yeah.
The theory of positive disintegration. People who are really like their selves, their sense of self, their sense of identity is kind of in flux. It's shattering, perhaps. And I really feel, quite frankly, a called. It feels like a bit of a sacred vocation, quite frankly, of coming alongside people in that process, and being with them as these different parts of themselves kind of reorganize themselves and come into a more coherent, integrated whole. That ideally and often is informed by what I would call their soul or inner nature. And so I hold space for people. I'm with people. I often use the metaphor of a greenhouse, me acting kind of as a greenhouse. And what does a greenhouse do? Well, it basically provides a micro habitat that provides the ideal environmental conditions for things to grow. And then, once in a while, I inject a little bit of fertilizer and maybe adjust the heat a little bit just to kind of, make sure things are on track. And it's just amazing to witness people kind of evolving and, quite frankly, going through revolutions of shifting into something that's much more aligned with their authentic self. And then seeing that then kind of be, seeing them go into the world with that new sense of self and really touching other people through those ripples.
Nice.
So that's kind of where I'm kind of at with my work and my passions.
I really like how you've described your role as, what would you call yourself? Therapist, a counselor?
You know what? Like all of these labels at this point, they all kind of reflect a certain facet. I don't know what I would actually define myself as. I just use various adjectives to help people symbolically elicit responses in people that kind of they'll understand. I basically just come to help people. I'm a helper. Yeah.
But so I love the way you described it, because you're basically a partner, a co-journeyman, rather than you there to give all the answers. You're there alongside people, and then you give some fertilizers here and there, which is a wonderful way of describing what you do.
Yeah, because fundamentally, most people have answers, their own answers, right? Or maybe their spiritual guidance. Maybe there's this, like, most people have something inside of them that can guide them, right? And my role is not to be that, because how could I? That's I'm kind of I'm coming alongside, and maybe this language is a little bit potentially. But kind of like almost like midwifing the process, in a sense of like, I have this sense of being able to see inside of people. I've always had this. It's got me into a lot of trouble, quite frankly, because, a lot of people don't want to be seen. But in the role of being a helper, where that kind of skill and that ability is actually ideal, right, to have. So I can kind of see the seed of potential inside a person. And often I'll get flashes of where that might actually be growing into. And I'm kind of in this process, in this relational matrix, where things are shifting and changing. And I'm not trying to hold too tightly to any modality, any kind of even outcome. I'm just kind of trying to be present in that process. And it seems like that presence, and I'm getting a little into the philosophical, like, subject object dualism, right? Like cause and effect. I really don't think that's actually the way that the universe works. The universe is much more non-linear than that. And perhaps our future selves are actually calling to our present selves to grow into who we can be. And by being present, right, to what is, it seems like that almost catalyzes this process of change and growth.
Absolutely. I see a Buddha figure behind you. And what you're saying reminds me of a lot of the current research done around quantum physics and Buddhism, and that kind of non-linear time frame.
Yes.
Jumping out of the philosophical stuff, do you consider yourself as a neurodivergent person? Another label.
Yeah, definitely. I would consider myself that. My felt sense of reality and what I see others' felt sense of reality to be quite distinct, generally speaking. Yeah, okay. Almost like I think I've only met in my life one person who feels like across the various domains of self, social, emotional, physical, intellectual, where there's actually like complete overlap.
Yeah. Well, just by the precision in language, can tell that the way you express yourself and perceive the world probably deviates from the norm.
Well, thank you.
It is a compliment. It's a neutral comment, but yes, edging on towards a compliment.
Yes.
I felt tempted to ask you what kind of labels would you associate yourself with, but I'm not sure it's a very meaningful question.
Yeah.
Well, it
is an interesting question. I actually, I'm almost intolerant of labels at this point. They don't make any sense to me anymore. And what I mean by that is it okay if I go in that direction, or do you feel
propelled?
Okay. So, and let me present it this way. So most people kind of understand like ego level consciousness, right? As in we are separate from other things. We want to protect ourselves. We want to accomplish things. Maybe we're driven by fear and insecurity. Often we worry about things. We ruminate about the past. Like that's kind of the way our ego consciousness tends to operate. And within ego consciousness, labels make sense. As in, I'm a white, heterosexual cisgender male. Those are things that describe kind of my ego consciousness and how that fits into societal labels and norms. But the way that I feel, or my felt sense in the world is I don't I don't identify with those labels as in helping them to define my reality, or helping to even define how other people might be perceiving me. It doesn't make sense to me anymore. And I guess where I'm coming from is like a different level of consciousness, where you mentioned Buddhism and you know, the research around quantum physics. I'm fascinated with this material right now. And really,
oh, we can talk about that.
Yeah. So the nature of reality. Yeah. Exactly. So the nature. My senses, quantum physics. The nature of reality is that basically everything just is.
Yeah.
Everything is like a potential. Everything is interrelated. Everything is interconnected. Everything is kind of fundamentally one. There is no space. There is no time. Right. That's really hard for ego consciousness to wrap around like that. Quite frankly, it's impossible. It doesn't translate, right? And that's why a lot of people have difficulty with it. And that's why it can cause massive trauma. I'm thinking of the work of Paul Levy. And he actually coined this term of like post-quantum trauma syndrome. As in, once you discover the quantum nature of reality, it's like it basically propagates a positive disintegration of self, because it's like you're not what you think you are. Everything that we think we are, everything that we think reality is basically just you have kind of particularized a potential. So if you think about the nature of reality just being these potential waves, right? The second you make an observation, the second you make a definition, the second you decide something, you've created a particle, and suddenly it exists in space and time. But that is only there because you've decided it's there. And so when I think about labels in this way, labels just particularize people and put them into boxes. And I'm so much more interested, and this probably reflects my level, of giftedness and, my intolerance for kind of being confined into, I just like, I need my autonomy. I need my independence. I need to be able to think and feel freely,
yeah,
like expansively. And in some ways that kind of almost reflects quantum level, like nature of reality, as in, I just want everything. I just want to exist in the place of potential. And necessarily that's hard to do. Like, you can't actually exist in that space as an ego, because, we would probably, or I would probably, I mean, you probably just, existentially just self-destruct in some ways. But, So going back to, you know, to labels and the quantum physics, I'm actually kind of a bit concerned with what I see in Western society of this obsession with labels. Because yes, we need language to understand ourselves, right? So like, for example, the gifted label can help us kind of turn towards certain literature, turn towards certain experiences, felt sense of resonance. Oh, okay, that makes sense. Like, that's a part of my experience as an ego in this world. But the second I then attach to that particle, I suddenly start seeing everything through that lens. And it's like, but that's not all of who I am, or that's not all of what the world is. I have taken this vast complexity and reduced it to something that's maybe manageable, or maybe makes me feel more secure about myself. But it's not real. As in, it's not... it's a fiction of sorts. And so holding this tension between kind of labels and identities, while recognizing it's all kind of, it's all just a basically cosmic soup that we're in, holding that tension between these two, I think is really important for kind of health and development.
Absolutely. I think we need to find a balance between the two. And I would agree with you that the Western society is very much obsessed with the... See, this whole label versus fluidity reminds me a bit of, you know, in MBTI. I know it's just another framework that uses things, but it's sometimes,
I like MBTI.
Personally, you like MBTI? Good. I mean, sure. I'm not a super expert, but I just find it quite a useful framework to think about things sometimes. So in there's a J and the P dilemma, the spectrum, where one is more about being very open to possibilities, and people almost struggle to finish things because they are so wanting to remain open. Whereas people on the very end of the J spectrum just want things to draw to a close. They just want the conclusions, the labels, the categories. Well, I'm quite J in my core, but I also think the society really encourages that. I have known people who are by nature very open and creative, and they just want to stay in the P zone, just to put it that way, open zone forever, and be creative and absorb all the information in the world before they draw things to a close. And yes, I mm-hmm. think our society do, and our society, when we talk about the Western, but I think it's pretty much the world these days.
Unfortunately, right? It's become global.
Exactly. Yes. So it's all about productivity, for which we need labels to navigate the world. We need categories, which is useful. Mm-hmm. But to advance the speed in which we do things and to keep up with things since industrial revolutions, we so need all these labels to streamline people, division of labors. So things like quote unquote efficient, but we cut out so much possibilities.
Absolutely. And keeping people, right, like adhering to kind of identities, keeping people feeling separate from one another, keeping people feeling fearful, right, and insecure, because we're these separate selves, right, who are basically, victims of this oppressive system. Like we all are to some degree, you know, obviously that varies depending on a person's kind of social position. That actually then propagates even more of the sense of like insecurity, separation, particularizedness. Oh, the enemy's out there. They're the bad person because they fit into a different group than us. Like it all of these kind of factors kind of, I think, come together to cause a lot of the, you know, like the capitalistic drive to like, be productive, like sacrifice yourself, work towards the future. Like that is, quite frankly, that's just addiction from a mental health perspective. It's like, it's all working towards something and denying kind of like what you're feeling in the moment and what's happening like around you. The whole thing actually is quite toxic for everybody. It really is.
Yeah. Well, amongst all these labels and categories, there's one that I'm intrigued to talk to you about, which is that of being a man.
I am a man, yes.
You are a man. You identify as being a man.
I do identify. Well, I mean,
you're a soul being in the male body.
I'll take that.
You don't have any attempt on changing that, so.
No, correct.
Agree on that, yes.
Listen, we've come around full circle here. Perfect, okay, good, yes.
What's the experience of being a hyper-aware, perhaps sensitive? Drop any of these labels if you don't like any of that, but I would say intellectually rigorous and intense and gifted and perhaps ecologically sensitive, hyper-aware men in today's world. Yeah. What's your own journey like? And I would like to hear in your take on, you already talk a little about your take on our hustle culture that we're in, but I'm also interested in your take on just masculinity in general, what it means to you and how you view toxic masculinity in the world. I noticed I just throw 5 questions at you.
It's okay.
Just take your own time.
Okay. That's great. Okay. So let me take a bit of a chronological approach to this. Because my experience of being a man, masculinity has definitely shifted substantially over time. So I live in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, just to situate myself a little bit, which is near Toronto, for people who aren't super familiar. I grew up in a pretty conservative Christian community. And so I went to, like a certain
that's kind of... That's another long...
Oh, that's another long thing, but it's also related to gender for sure, right? And identity and masculinity. So I went to, a church with all people who were like me. So I have Dutch heritage on both sides. My father's an immigrant from the Netherlands. My mother's from the United States, but you go back a couple generations, she's from the Netherlands. And there was all these like Dutch immigrants. And there's a certain kind of denomination of Christianity that called Christian Reformed that I grew up in. I went to a school that was Christian Reformed. I went to church that was Christian Reformed. I was around all of these people who kind of looked like me, ostensibly. But again, with the giftedness and with these other kind of pieces, like I never really fit in, although I did learn to mask quite substantially. And in terms of like being a man, in Christianity, and in conservative Christianity, it's like, women are a certain way, right? And men are a certain way. And that was like almost indoctrinated into my soma, of like, okay, so as a man, I get married. I have a family. I'm the head of the household. I'm the leader. I don't have emotions. I don't show emotions. I try to bury those away and stay in my head. So initially in my kind of academic pursuits, I went into the sciences, biology and chemistry in particular, first because I love nature, but it also allowed me to feel like I was kind of in the safe zone, away from emotion, right? And away from vulnerability. Because that's kind of this masculine kind of soup that I was kind of brought up in. Patriarchal religion, God who judges, God who's masculine. Although as I've had some conversations with God over the years, apparently that's really a misconception, but that's a whole nother kind of conversation.
Oh, that is a wonderful conversation to have. The impact of having a masculine God archetype in our culture and what does that do?
Horrible. Horrible.
You think?
Often. I mean, I guess I mean, it's not completely. No, it's pretty horrible. So, masculine, feminine energies, there had to be balance in order to have wholeness, in order to be full, fully human, to be just real, quite frankly. But I'm just going to kind of jump back to the chronology. So,
yes, please. Thank you.
Okay, now I'm trying to think of where I was. Okay, so, you know, biology, chemistry, kind of shutting off my emotions. I'm also very athletic. So I always was able to use sports and use my success with my body. I'm tall as well. And so people, like, I use that kind of mask of the bot, like masculine, as a way of kind of hiding as well, right? It's like, I'm this athletic guy. Nobody has to know who I am underneath the surface. Like all people will see is kind of this facade that I put on. I'm the scientist. I'm athletic. You know, I'm kind of like a bit mysterious and distanced from things. Well, when I turned 25, that all completely collapsed and disintegrated. And it was not pretty, quite frankly.
So when I was 20, so at 25.
Well, my first dark night of the soul.
Disintegration.
I've had two thus far. So at age 25, my daughter was born. My daughter Natalie, my first child. She was unexpectedly born at home. Labor moved really quickly. We had midwives that came to the house. We had two midwives and each had students. So there was these four midwives, me and my wife who was giving birth. It was an intense, quite catastrophic experience existentially, quite frankly. The whole thing, like, what the heck? Like the body and childbirth, like there's something, it's got to be a better way to do this. But anyways, when she emerged, and I was the first person to get to hold her and against my chest, my bare chest. And, you know, I cut her umbilical cord.
Oh, wow.
And suddenly in that moment, it's like, you gotta fucking deal with your shit. Like, it just shook me, kind of like, you gotta, like, if you don't become real, she's gonna have to do all of this work. It was suddenly this like existential, like, I can't hand this down another generation. The religious stuff, the patriarchal stuff, the masculine stuff, the dissociation from emotion, the intergenerational trauma. There's a lot of layers, which unfortunately we probably won't have time to go into today. And suddenly something shocked me there. Okay. And that sent me into an existential depression. Quite frankly, I was diagnosed with, you know, anxiety and depression. Also bipolar. I wasn't diagnosed with bipolar, but I was put on a mood stabilizer because basically, again, the way that the medical system looks at these things, they put them into boxes and it's like, oh, it sounds to me like you're just stressed out, right? Because you had a child. And it's like, no, that's not actually what was happening. Fortunately, I was able to find a Jungian therapist who could see the deeper side of what was happening, that my soul was actually emerging and this was creating a spiritual crisis, which was manifesting with anxiety and depression. I started working with my dreams. I started seeing patterns in my dreams. My intuition started getting heightened, right? And intuition, you know, when you think about like masculine and feminine energies, like, these are very complex topics, of course, but, you know, intuition and felt sense and emotion, right? those are actually my natural habitats as a person. So in a lot of ways, I'm actually much more, again, I'm using the masculine and feminine in terms of energies, not genders, but I'm actually much more feminine in a lot of ways than I am masculine. Like I live in an intuitive soup. I'm very emotion kind of based. I tune into, I'm a helper. I'm a carer. That's really kind of my essence as a person. It's always been my essence, but I buried it because of my social conditioning. So that shattered through. Couldn't
How
work.
How common do you think that is? That they... men with feminine energy being shoved into the man box and the church
box. I think
it
happens all the time. I think it's
That's
so tragic.
That's my experience too.
So tragic. And a lot of the men that I work with, again, there's a similar pattern, right? Of like, of not being in touch with their bodies. Like, whoa, like, I mean, for gifted folks in general, I often notice people's energies,
is,
right? Up in the head, rapid cycling between emotion and thought, but there's no grounding. There's no in the bodiness. Yeah. There's a disconnection from kind of intuition, disconnection from emotion.
Two things I see common is the intellectual bypassing and the spiritual bypassing.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. I you know, a lot of people actually aren't even in their bodies at all, quite frankly. And so, again, a little bit of segue in the work that I do, it's a combination of like, you know, bringing people down into their bodies, you know, releasing felt, you know, somatic kind of tension and things like that, but also, you know, working through trauma and working through memory so that energy can flow more cleanly and more kind of authentically through the system. But that's a little bit of an aside.
Well, you said it's a segue, but I can imagine
Should we segue?
Listening to this who,
yes.
who are in, you know, who resonates it with that would be like, oh my God, then what do I do? So your segue is probably what people really want to hear.
Okay. Okay. So what do I do is, so the first thing is I for myself, I ensure that I'm in a balanced place in my body. People are polar. A lot of people are familiar with like the chakra system, the seven chakras. Yeah. Like I kind of come to a place of balance in my energy. So I'm kind of grounded, but I'm also open. So there's like a kind of a flow and that. And this is kind of my felt understanding and kind of what I've intuitively picked up on. It's just holding that energy inside of myself and in my my office, maybe over Zoom, seems to elicit, it precipitates the same potential in the other person, because this is just the natural state of what it means to be human, right? This is what if we weren't all traumatized multi-generationally and facing systemic discrimination and abuse and that the state that we all deserve, quite frankly. And so just kind of being in that energy, and it seems to like people often will respond to me and say, yeah, it's just like I feel different. I feel calmer just by being in that presence. So there's an energetic unconscious exchange that's happening. So there's the talking, right? There's the talking, there's the conceptualizing, which our egos and our minds like, right? They like a little bit of framework to hold on to, especially when you're gifted and intellectually kind of predisposed, let's just say. But most of what's actually happening is completely unconscious. And so when I'm talking with a person and I'm listening to their story and I'm listening to what something they went through as a child, a trauma, I'm listening to the content, but fundamentally, actually what I'm paying attention to is what's happening. What am I observing in their energy, in their body? Where are they? And in some ways, and this is, this is like kind of going further into kind of my evolution, as a practitioner, is I'm able to kind of work with energy a little bit more now. And I can almost kind of like help a person's energy to kind of settle down. And so that's happening kind of unconsciously while there's kind of content being discussed. And over time, change happens, integration happens. People's issues, their symptoms seem to kind of resolve.
Yeah.
And I don't actually, I'm not in charge of that process. Again, like the, you know, talk about the greenhouse. But there's something kind of magical and mysterious and beautiful about it. And that's also why I love my work as a divergent person. I'm actually INFJ. I am a J. Like my closure. But,
same.
But it seems like a lot of folks are INFJ in
I know. It's a rarest. I'm not sure about that anymore.
I know. It's so fascinating. So it just seems like through a relationship, through a relational matrix, through discussing things through exchanges of energy, change happens. People kind of come to some kind of a knowing. Parts of their self all of a sudden come online. I'm thinking about that particular client right now. And, you know, she's come across like four childhood parts inside of herself that just seemed to kind of, through our relationship, all of a sudden they started coming out. Like a really young part, like a 2-year-old part, and like a 6-year-old part, a 13-year-old part, 19-year-old part. And suddenly it's like all of these different parts that were lost into the past through trauma, suddenly they start coming out and online. I'm not necessarily doing anything directly or intentionally to make that happen. It just seems to happen because of the nature of the relational matrix. And I'm convinced, and this is probably going into my future work, in therapy and maybe in writing and sharing other things as well, is that what is leading to change is not modality. It's actually the presence of, it's something much deeper, and it can't actually be extracted from the moment or from the individuals involved. So I could try to explain to somebody what I do, and they might do the same thing, but it might not actually work at all because it's not necessarily their essence as a person and how they're kind of called to work. So we all have to find our individual way of being in the world and kind of what's authentic for ourselves. And when we can do that, when we have the privilege of doing that in some ways, we can then kind of share that with others. And it almost kind of like, I can almost feel it like, almost like a lighthouse kind of beaconing out, and it kind of like it sparks something inside of others and they start feeling it. And then it kind of just spreads over space and time. Like I think that is, such an important part of the healing that has to happen in our world.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying, fortunately, I do think even the conventional world of psychotherapy is edging in that direction, with Ellen Shaw doing a lot of research around the right brain to right brain connections. And I mean, forget about science. Carl Rogers started by saying that all you have to do mm-hmm. is to create the right condition and then things just happen.
Yeah.
And I am very glad that there are more and more people. I mean, there are lots of merits to models like CBT and DBT that provides a very structured, smoking cessation program, something like that, or AA. But at the same time, I do think there's so much room for this kind of deeper, fluid, open-ended work that you're doing and I see myself doing too. So thank you.
Yeah, I would agree that there definitely is a place for the more structured kind of, let's say, solution-focused approaches when maybe you're dealing just with, say, smoking cessation or kind of like just kind of thought patterns that need to be kind of challenged. Again, for me personally, the danger for me, or the what I see as the potential danger, again, you all of a sudden put something into a box. This is what it is. Are we sure that's what it is, though? Are we sure that the why are they smoking? Oh, well, they went through. Okay, so now we got to dig down to the actual kind of bedrock of what's happening there. Oh, and then their mother. Oh, their grand. And then suddenly you realize what is manifest has nothing to do with actually the real source of the problem, and I guess connecting issues in our world, right? Like the inner and the outer are so interrelated, going back to kind of quantum physics. But if you look at the problems in the world and how humans tend to solve problems in the world is we look for quick fixes and we don't actually go deep enough to say like what's actually happened. What is the actual root of quite frankly, the fucked upness of society? There's never digging down through all of these sedimentary layers, or rarely digging down to actually find out what's wrong. And that's mirrored in a lot of professions, including therapy, where there can be kind of deep work, but like going down. And I know there's an element of privilege in having the time and resources to do that. But when you can and you get to that treasure, like underneath the surface, everything above it, it's kind of like you find that, and when you shift the foundation, suddenly the whole thing just the whole structure above it just reorganizes itself into coherence. And actually, it's the most efficient way to actually deal with the problem, because if you're just dealing with the symptom, or it's going to come back. It's going to come back in some other form. There's a part that's going to come back to defend, right? If you're looking at kind of an internal family systems perspective, which ultimately is no different from Jungian psychotherapy, really, if you think about it.
The archetypes,
complexes, yeah. Just different language to describe the same thing. And then again, in the profession, we get all excited about these new things as if we think there's something like completely new. And it's like that like almost kind of like adolescent or childlike exuberance about something shiny and new. It can be very foolish, right? Something shiny and new may be shiny, and then all of a sudden you see it, and then beneath the surface, it's like it's not actually providing what it pretends to espouse. Or somebody already thought about this 1,000 years ago. Why are we getting like? Why don't we slow down a little bit here, dig a little bit deeper here, and maybe if we can kind of find the source of the problems. I'm thinking like I've done a lot of work with environmentalism and ecology, right? And I tend to take a very deep ecological approach that, like, fundamentally, until we understand the human psyche and what predisposes us to destroy our own homes and destroy our own selves, any kind of a technological solution is going to be a band-aid on top of something, which is eventually just going to disintegrate. So the felt sense that I have with environmentalism is the same felt sense that I have with people. It's the same felt sense that I have with social systems, religious systems. We have to go deep. We have to get the full big picture. We have to have coherence if we're going to have health and wholeness.
Beautiful. Beautifully said.
Thank you. Yes.
So for someone going back to the masculinity, yes. Oh, there's so many topics I could go through. Like, personally,
I hope it's okay that I'm going off in multiple directions. Oh, that's cool. Okay.
It's hard for our audience, but we're having fun.
Yes.
I mean, I still like archetypes. I still like labels. I mean, there are probably merits to something like IFS, organizing and reorganizing archetypes to something that is much more easily digestible by the general public and being used. I love the tarot card, for example. It's just like a useful way of thinking about the world. So is the MBTI that we've talked about. But going back to the idea of being an intuitive spiritual man in the world, let's say someone is pretty quite trapped in that church, school, family mold. And two questions. One is, how do you see that? So 10 questions. How do you see, and pick one. How do you see that actually affecting their relationship and their place in the world, or perhaps the sense of loneliness? Because growing up with the social conditioning of a woman, might not be able to speak to it as poignantly as you do, of being trapped in that predicament and the felt sense of loneliness and what that's like. How might that affect their intimacy and relationship?
Oh yeah, it's devastating.
Yeah,
it's devastating. I mean, it's devastating. I mean, I fundamentally can probably only speak accurately to my own personal experience, but with empathy and intuition, understand other like a lot of men are very lonely, and they don't even know it. They don't even know that they're lonely. And if a man has, let's say, more of these kind of like sensitivities and feminine qualities, I mean, I was actually just talking with my son yesterday evening, and we just had a snowstorm here, and him and some of his friends were having a snowball fight, and one of his good friends, who's very, very sensitive and gifted as well, he got hit with a snowball, and he just like broke down crying. And then he went home from school. He was just like completely devastated. And my son was saying like all the friends were kind of like, what's wrong with this guy? Like, why is he so sensitive? Like toughen up. And it's like that is just so toxic, to a sensitive soul, right? It's kind of like, I'm not allowed to be me in the world. I'm not allowed to express my emotion. And, you know, in this child's case, thankfully, they have a wonderful kind of supportive family who are there and celebrate his emotions and everything else. But for those who don't have that kind of support, it's like, okay, well, I'm going to shut that down. Okay. And when we shut down parts of ourselves or aspects of our authentic selves, we're not really in relationship with our full self. We're kind of fragmented. And that necessarily then affects our relationships and the relational matrix. Because if I'm hiding something from myself, or kind of, if I have anger inside, or if I have some kind of sadness that I'm trying to kind of suppress, that's going to affect my intimacy with other people. I can't really be intimate and open and vulnerable if I've been told and shown that that's not it, that like you just can't be that. And what I noticed with a lot of men, myself included historically, is I didn't even know what I was missing. I didn't
even have
know.
The language for the feeling.
I had no language, and I had no consciousness of it, because there's also the deeper pattern that this socialization of men in Westernized society, this isn't like, this has been going on for generations, right? The effects of patriarchy. And so most people are being born, most men are being born already with like a predisposition, you know, epigenetically and energetically towards kind of shutting those aspects of themselves off. Yeah. And so you don't even know, you don't know what you don't know, right? And there's so many men walking around, kind of feeling maybe something's missing or feeling some kind of a disconnect, yes, but it's being mirrored back to them by everybody else. So it's like, oh, this is just the way it is to be human. This is just the way it is. Like in environmentalism, this is referred to as environmental amnesia, as in you grow up in a certain kind of setting and you assume that the environment's always been that way. You assume you've always been that way. And it's like, no, we have, again, going deep, I just can't help but going deep down to the past. We have to recognize, how did humans get to this place? What parts of humanity need to be cut off? I mean, it's no surprise that, you know, witches needed to be burned and indigenous peoples need to be eradicated, right? People who are connected with themselves, with spirit, with the earth, they can't be controlled. And in order to be controlled in this system that we're in, those parts of ourselves, the intuition, the groundedness, that needs to be destroyed. And so, you know, men, and I think a lot of women as well, are kind of walking around as consciously just fragmented and not even realizing that life could be different. And that's really sad. I mean, it's tragic, actually. And again, as a therapist working with people, part of the tragedy is like, we might come to a place of wholeness, right, in the therapy. But then so many people are then going back out to environments, to families, to social roles, to jobs, where they have to shut off these parts of themselves again. They're not actually allowed to be whole within the structures of the system that we're all governed by to greater or lesser extents. And so I guess that goes to my deeper kind of my sense of like what I'm here to kind of do is to try to improve that, to try to help people on an individual level, but also to try to shift those patterns on a more systemic level, and really working deeply individually, or working at the, I mean, you're working at two ends of the same thing, right? Because it's all kind of one interconnected whole quantumly. But I'll leave it there, I guess. But no, I think, yeah. I mean, I can't really think of a man that I've worked with, who is not disconnected from parts of their body. Yeah. Who was not disconnected from some of their emotions. Often there's a lot of anger, like a lot of anger inside.
Where do these anger go? And what usually prompted them to come to you? What does their, what triggers that light of a soul for them? Is there a theme that you've noticed? Or how do people wake up?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. How do people wake up? There's a sense of just timing and context. Oh, that reminds me of a client that I had, yesterday, who is going through, you know, from Dabrowski's language of positive disintegration, their kind of sense of self is faltering. And we were kind of exploring like, oh, why is this happening now? And we both came to kind of this conclusion that they're in a place in their life that's quite stable. Like they have a home, they have a place that they feel comfortable in. And it's like the psyche seems to be able to kind of say, okay, so now we can disintegrate without dying, without psychologically or physically dying. And yeah, it was just so interesting. All of a sudden, this client picked up they found a picture of them when they were a child. And again, unpronounced to me, they brought it into the session. And suddenly there was like this integration of the child, this realization that like this whole disintegration process is really them picking up parts of themselves in the past, this free-spirited, beautiful, open, adventurous young girl. And she's able to now come out because the environmental conditions kind of in, let's say, ego consciousness and the system are stable enough to be able to handle the disintegration so that they can become more whole.
Yeah. So like,
it's just fascinating.
Back to the beginning of what you said, as long as the fertilizers are there, the conditions safe enough. That's how I answer people to the questions of like, what's the timeline and things? What do we do with the inner child? I just said, well, it will do its own job if you feel safe enough.
Yes.
But then where do they find safety in this chaotic, mad world with the election coming up? Where do they find an inner locus of safety, though?
That's a great, a very great and complex question. It has to be downloaded to the individual level, right? Because everybody's context is unique. Some people can't, Amy. If a person like is say living in poverty, they are in abusive relationships and they're part of this system that's affecting everybody else, like to some degree. It's like those. Let's just say, even if they had the resources, right, and the mental health system's broken too, and it, you know, that's a whole kind of another discussion. But let's just say they were able to come and see a person who could maybe help them kind of come. It may not even be a wise thing to try to integrate, right? Because you're going to get re-traumatized. Yeah. Right. And so there's a timing and a contextual piece, and there's a tragedy, quite frankly, Amy, like that so many people are existing in relationships and contexts in which it's not even a good idea to be healed. That those adaptive mechanisms of survival, right? Like the psyche's brilliant. Evolution has provided us with these amazing coping mechanisms that they may get in the way of wholeness and a felt sense of health, right? But dissociating.
I absolutely and repressing, love that you right? say that. Well, right? I think.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, I made that mistake a lot as a beginning therapist too, where it's always about breaking down the defenses when actually the defenses deserve a lot of respect. And sometimes the circumstances doesn't allow the person to disintegrate and then reintegrate.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think just going back to my own kind of personal story as well, at age 25, right, at that point, I had established myself in my career, right? I had a home. I had a stable relationship. And so something about that whole situation, the factors kind of came together to allow me to disintegrate and allow me then to reintegrate. And then anyways, I went through another one in my mid-30s, and I'm kind of at the tail end of that disintegration. But it's like those conditions cannot just be, those conditions are fundamental aspects of the healing process. And defense mechanisms, like you were saying, dissociation, for example, which is rampant, quite frankly, in Westernized society. If I was to kind of, you know, let's say through an IFS model, kind of encourage that protector part to take down their guard and allow that child to kind of come out, and then they were to walk out the door and get yelled out by their abusive husband, that's going to just ruin them, right? That's going to cause more damage. And so there's so many constraints, right, on the work that therapists can do, because we're embedded in these dysfunctional systems. And from a larger kind of existential kind of perspective, and again, I keep on using the word tragedy. It really is a tragedy that humans, or some humans anyways, have created systems of oppression that preclude human health and healthy relationship and wholeness. Intuitively, over the long arc, I think things may move in a better direction, but intuitively in a shorter arc, the times that we're going through and that we will be going through, and of course, my how it's going to affect me is going to be different than it affects another person based on their kind of social position and everything else. It's going to be really hard, right? Like climate change and political unrest, like all, if you have kind of eyes to see and ears to hear, and you're paying attention to and understand how systems work, holy smokes, like things are, we're going through a disintegration as a global village. Will that be a positive one? How long will that take? How can we best, you know, as practitioners or people who are maybe aware or awakened to this, how can we best support that process and try to make it better?
Yeah. There are so many things and directions we can go to. And yet today, yes, we might not have enough time. Would you be open to coming back and another time for more topics if that's okay?
I would love to come back.
Oh, nice.
Well, I feel like we've maybe hit on like 6.5% of some of the things that we could probably go into.
And maybe, yeah, I can recruit the comments of the audience to see what they would really like to hear you talk about, describe, or empathize with. But we still have a bit of time, and just to maybe picking up on one of the threads that we have started today, the idea of being a hyper-aware gifted man, was it hard to find intimacy and partnerships? I know that you have a lovely family. Not everyone is as lucky.
It's complicated, yes. Yes. Yes.
Any suggestions for that question, fellow gifted men out there?
Okay. So I spent, again, it's hard to separate the trauma healing, right, that I've been going through and have gone through. And so I wasn't even conscious of, you know, that hyper awareness. I had suppressed it and shut it down and tried to kind of, and so for a lot of time, there was not real intimacy in relationship of any real authentic nature. I was just existing as a monad and just trying to conjure up. I would typically choose people, again, unconsciously, who wouldn't be aware of it, because yes, I was smart enough to adapt and mask, right?
Wow.
And
keep your defense mechanism was smart enough to protect itself.
It was very, very smart, too smart, quite frankly, in some ways. So as that mask has kind of come off, as I've come into more wholeness, So I just turned 40, but I would say I spent 37 years of my life in profound loneliness. Yeah. Like alone, disconnected from myself, disconnected from others. As I've gone through healing, it's caused a lot of problems in my existing relationships, because as the mask comes off and my authentic needs come out and my hyper awareness comes out and my need for deep, authentic, meaningful connection comes out, so many relationships have kind of just faded off and faded off into the background. And then new people have kind of come in, somewhat serendipitously. But it's really only been in the past 2 to 3 years that I've had vulnerable, authentic, like no mask relationships. And they've been profoundly transformative and also very painful. Mutual triggering happening in relationship, because again, that's part of healing, that healing the wounds that so many of us kind of go through. And you know, I've only really met in my life thus far one person who it really feels kind of I feel at home with, like across the multiple dimensions of who I am. And so from an ego kind of perspective, there is a sense of loneliness, definitely. I'm so good at connecting with people and understanding them, and I rarely feel that being reciprocated in a meaningful and felt way. And just going to the, you know, the other levels of consciousness and kind of the more spiritual directions that I've kind of moved in, is my love of nature and the natural world, right? And Mother Nature and, you know, being in touch with energies and being in touch with it, that provides me so much comfort and solace. And even like quantum physics, I honestly find very therapeutic, because it's like, there is no separation, Eric. You are the world is you, right? It's just my ego that feels separate. Yeah. And yet at the same time, I do feel lonely. I do feel misunderstood. almost, I mean, most of the time, I don't understand, I don't fit into society in any kind of conventional manner. I'm kind of at a somewhat distance in terms of having a private practice. The therapy world in some ways feels a little bit kind of foreign to me. Like, that's not really 100% what I'm doing. And the ways that people think and feel, and the ways that, you know, it just seems like most people are just living at this level of like, of regurgitating the news and social scripts and superficial conversation that like, I can't even like it feels corrosive to my soul. And so there's a tension between like, of course I want to belong and I want to be in a group. Like those are human drives. And yet to be my authentic self in a group causes a lot of corrosion, because so often the dynamics and the personalities and the other things going on there aren't actually resonating kind of with me as a person. So then I either have to mask or I have to tolerate. So there's, I mean, that could be a whole nother episode probably of talking about relationship. And it's hard. It's really hard to navigate the world as a hyper-aware sensitive man, I think, as a person who's divergent. And yet, in coming into, you know, more alignment and relationship with myself, and with the nature of reality, even as I'm just saying that, all of a sudden, energy also drops down, and suddenly I just feel like a tree, like I'm just here, and so very complex. Yeah.
Well, I know we're not about quick advice here, but any words of kindness you might say, if not to the fellow sensitive man, maybe to your younger self?
Don't give up. Just don't give up on life. Don't give up. Yeah. That things can get better. Basically don't stop. You're not alone. It's going to be okay. So.
This is deeply moving.
It is, yeah.
I'm glad we connected.
I am too.
Yeah, I think I already see you as a fellow dust in the universe and a friend.
Yes. Yeah, me too, Amy. Me too.
Right. Well, I'll let you go for today and let's see if we can find
another. Yeah, I got to get my tissues. So, yeah. Yeah.
I think tears are beautiful. I want to say to all the beautiful, gifted, sensitive men out there that your tears are beautiful. They don't make you weak. They don't mean, no matter what people have said to you in the past, whatever the drill sergeants, your sport coach, you know, hustle culture have said to you, tears are beautiful and they are very attractive.
Yeah.
Go with love. I'm sure we'll connect again.
Absolutely.
Thank you for today.
Take care.
All right. Take care. We'll speak soon.
Bye. Yes.
Hey, thank you so much for tuning in. For more, please head to eggshelltherapy.com. There you will find more stories, articles, and resources for people just like me and you. Bye now.
Keep putting one foot in front of the other. Moving forwards, never looking back. Just one more foot in front of all those countless others, and we're there. Imagine.